Okay. So anybody has an answer to my question? What information integration system was threatened with a lawsuit this past week? It was all the news everywhere. Wikipedia was threatened? No. I didn't know that. Why was Wikipedia threatened? It has to be an information integration system. Wikipedia is a collaborative system. You guys don't do any actual news following? Leave it up to me. What? It had to do with some folks who, basically it's an integration of, I mean the company which sued them was Amazon. Now do you remember? Now do you know? It was an information integration system. It was on the news. How much more can I do for you guys? I mean, it's like, what? Uh-huh. Yeah. So this couple of grad students are undergrad students in Netherlands, essentially doing information integration. What they did was, for every Amazon book or movie or anything you are watching, there is a Firefox plugin. If you download it, it will then show you how you can get it from Pirate Bay, which I'm supposed not to know what it is, but it's a illegal torrent download site. So they felt, why waste, you know, precious time actually looking at the book, you know, and go into the Google window and say that book and torrent, and then you have to actually go to Pirate Bay and get the thing. So here, essentially, as you are looking at the Amazon page, it will show you, click here to get it free. And this was information integration, right? It's integrated two different data sources, right? And rather than get an A plus in their exam, they were, you know, slapped with a lawsuit. You know, Amazon said, you take it down or we're going to sue you. And they took it down. So there you go. So the interesting point about that is information integration, once you start integrating stuff across, I mean, there are legal things, there are illegal things you can do. And this was one of the small examples of the illegal things you can do. There are other interesting kinds of things. For example, a topic that I don't spend that much time anymore, I mean, I would probably not have any time to spend here, is privacy preserving information integration. Okay, so the idea is that there are all sorts of databases out there that are available publicly right now. And if you can do, you know, effective information integration, then you can figure out, for example, you know, who's got what kinds of diseases. Now, why would you want to know? I mean, presumably, you would go and tell it to somebody else, and their life would be miserable after that, okay? Or you could find out, in fact, each data source thinks they're being very careful, because they'll only give partial part of the information. Now, what does this tell you? There was a big database, and all the sources are virtualized, I mean, are materialized views on the fragments of the data, right? Now, sometimes you do not want the actual tuple to be reconstructed ever. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, each database might say, no, look, I'm not breaching anybody's privacy. I put their student posting ID and their grade. And, you know, posting ID, nobody's supposed to know. And then somebody else said, I'm not breaching their privacy, I'm just putting their name and their posting ID in their thing. And so now you combine both of these, you basically know who is failing and who is passing in a certain course, right? So in fact, an interesting issue is, what would be the way you would ensure, if in fact, you know, sources are being created not in a non-adversarial fashion, how do you make sure that they would preserve privacy? And furthermore, if they're not being done in a centralized fashion, how do you realize that privacy has been compromised because of the sources out there? If you don't know how to integrate a couple of sources, then you obviously did not know that, you know, I know that somebody's social security number. Okay, if you don't know how to put them together. And so it's an interesting scenario. Much of what we've been talking about in the last couple of classes, this information integration, it has challenges, but to some extent, we hope there are challenges, because if it's too easy to do, then we will have a whole new set of problems to deal with, which is how to stop important information, private information from getting openly available. Already there are all sorts of, you know, worries of that kind. You know, for example, how many of you know the great AOL query logs controversy? Yes, what is it? Exactly. So the thing was, in fact, you know, at one time people felt that if you want to really kickstart the research into information retrieval and web search, etc., one thing to do is to provide to the general research community what Google's, Yahoo's, and AOL's of the world had for free, which is they had a user population, so they had the query logs. Okay. So they essentially wanted to give it out to the researchers so that researchers can, in essence, do interesting work with it, you know, and improve the search and so on. Now, they thought that they basically sanitized the query logs so that there's not any information out there that would identify the user. However, then 3 days after they opened it up, you know, people figured out, you know, who is who. And in fact, they were able to show that, you know, if you are asking questions about addresses for a, let's say, hospital or a Kmart in a certain zip code, that's your search, then it's a very high likelihood that either you are Kmart manager and wants to know, you know, what are all the Kmart stores, or you are near that store. That's why you wanted it, okay? And so if you put together a whole bunch of queries, you suddenly increase the certainty as to who might be asking the query. So in fact, New York Times then ran an article where the, you know, the basically reporters figured out who this old lady was. You know, thankfully she wasn't asking any obscene queries. So they went to New Jersey and knocked on her door and said, "Didn't you ask all these queries?" And you know, she almost had a heart attack. And then AOL had to take out the query log. Okay. So the question, of course, is how do you give out the query log so that this kind of thing cannot happen? And Netflix, when it gave the Netflix prize, they also had to make open the movie information. But in essence, they had to learn from the AOL's problems. Plus, of course, probably people are not as worried about being identified in terms of the movies they watch, you know, than by being identified in terms of which hospitals they frequent, for example. Okay. Anyway, so it's kind of an interesting connection to what you're doing here and, you know, what's happening outside. Now, if in fact Amazon and Netherlands students and Firefox plugin are examples of information integration, what kind of information integration are they? We remember we talked about all sorts of dimensions. What's the use of theory if you can't apply it whenever you see an example, right? So what kind of information integration is this? It's horizontal, okay? So it's not vertical, it's horizontal, because it's doing joins across two different sources. What else? What else can we say about it? Is it a generalized information integration architecture, or is it, remember we had one slide where we talked about upfront work versus everything has been done and it just works for this particular one case. And the later being mashups, and the former being general information integration architecture. So this Amazon guy, the one that I'm describing to you, does this look like? What does it look like? It's more of a mashup. So it's basically, they just, you know, combine these two sources. And so for every pair of sources, you need a separate Firefox plugin. And then that pair of sources will, I mean, one of them at least need a lawyer to sue you, you know, so basically to complete this thing. But, so that's the way it does. Whereas if you just set up one, single general information integration architecture, then they just have to sue the whole field with one layer and be done with it. Okay. So what I'm going to do for today's class is essentially until I guess about 2:30 or maybe 2:25, I would do more discussion on information integration, query processing aspects, and in particular also the stuff that I said I will discuss, which is imprecision and incompleteness in information sources, and what can you do to handle them. And then basically from 2:30 to 2:45, I will say I concluded. I'll do some review, but you guys did a good job of review yourself. In essence, I found out that basically mostly we didn't survive after the first midterm, because all the review is just what happened after the midterm. So more or less. So hopefully I will do more of a review of what we did in this topic today, and then, you know, I'll end. Okay. And then if you have specific things to make, you know, please stop me. But I would strongly encourage you to look at your own reviews, your own collective reviews, because, you know, I used to show this Far Side cartoon where we, you know, basically it doesn't matter what I thought I did. What it matters is whether you collectively got something, and, you know, that's the union of what you guys got, essentially. Okay, so if the class thinks we more or less slept through after the midterm, then so be it. You know, I can be angry at you and give you a hard final exam, which I still can do, but, you know, but that's the way it is. Okay, so what we were talking about last time was learning source statistics, and then we talked about learning coverage and overlap statistics. And the one thing that I wanted to point out, I sort of said this quickly, so I want to go through it a little more carefully, once more at least. Remember, I was talking about providing a sort of a query class hierarchy from the coverage overlap statistics to see which classes are, so to do agglomerative clustering. And the question, of course, is the distance was described in terms of essentially not the content vector, but this vector really, the way to look at it is it's for each query, then you can talk about a vector of this following form. What is its probability of coverage on S1, S2, etc. Let's say there are only three sources. Okay, S1, S2, S3, then S1, S2, S2, S3, S3, S1. S1, S2, S3. These are the only numbers you need, right, in terms of coverages and overlaps, if you only have three sources. So every query can be thought of as a vector of this length. Do you understand? Okay, so this is Q1, which corresponds to this, and then Q2 corresponds to a different vector of probabilities. And you're trying to differentiate between, you know, you're trying to decide how far or close are they. Okay. And what I decided in this particular case was I essentially took the Euclidean norm of that vector. So I essentially said if there's another query, Q dash, which has another vector, then I essentially subtract like terms, square them and add them. That's the Euclidean norm. That's what we're doing. So that's the distance. Okay. So the important point, of course, is you can define distance in terms of content, in terms of distribution of the query on the sources, which is what we cared about here. And to see that that actually works, or at least worked in this one system, I need to, I believe, look at, show you this. So this was actually, for that BibFinder system, this was actually the query hierarchy shown in a sort of a flat fashion. So the indentations are children, for example. Okay. So for example, you would notice that a query class essentially contains IEEE computer and ICML together. Now, you might think IEEE computer and ICML don't actually have too much common in terms of their content. Okay. But we are not talking about their content. What we are talking about is are the sources that carry IEEE computer articles also the same sources which carry ICML? Basically, what it turns out is these two are two very important publication venues in computer science. And so any bibliography source might wind up having information about them. And so they are close because they are distributed on the sources in the same way. Essentially. Do you understand what I'm saying? So I was just trying to get you to think that what we were computing there essentially is not distances, but the distribution of the query over the sources. And it can be done because, as I said, this is like a vector. Okay. Now, of course, you know, one problem with this, and all sorts of things I won't be talking about here, is one problem with this is if you have like 10 sources, this vector starts becoming larger and larger. Okay, but all you really need is you can decide, for example, that I would care mostly only about pairwise, up to pairwise overlaps. in which case you just truncated both of these vectors right up there. Okay. Okay. And the other one other thing that I wanted to mention, which we kind of went over before, is this, which is originally before people started thinking about quantitative coverage and overlap statistics, which is the one that I was showing you in that example. Okay. What they wound up doing, what they used to do essentially, is they would assume that, so there are like two ways of doing it. One is the way I described in terms of quantitative overlap statistics. The other is the sources themselves provide information about what parts of the, what classes of the query are they complete for. Okay. The reason I bring this up is these have a nice name. They call local closed world assumptions. Okay. So if you have a source, now here is the interesting, this picture is kind of worth looking at. Here is, you know, let's say a movie source. Okay. And basically it has some set of movies in it. The green stuff is the set of movies that actually are present in the source. Now, the cleanest way to describe the source is to give the contents. You know, what movies do I have? Exactly these. Okay? But obviously it's hard to reason with that. Okay? In fact, it's an irregular structure. What the source would do is provide an advertised description. An advertised description which claims way more than it actually is able to give. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it says, oh yeah, I'll give you all Hollywood movies. A nice big circle. Okay. Really what they have is they have Hollywood movies, mostly, most of the Hollywood movies made in between 1959 and 1971, but only 50% of those made between 79 and 82, and also none of the movies made by the following director and so on and so forth. But if you start giving that kind of a description, essentially you're giving the full content of the sources. Okay? So you're getting by with the upper bound description. So whenever a source describes itself, it's an upper bound description of the source. Okay. Now, if the source or you provide to the source, I mean, you provide a local closed world assumption. Okay. So, for example, local closed world assumption here might say, I am definitely complete for all Woody Allen movies. That means every movie that Woody Allen made, I have information on them. Okay. I'm definitely complete for 1987 movies because that year I didn't sleep. I figured out all the movies that were made and, you know, I have information on them. Now, those essentially would be subsets of this. Now, here is one subset. Okay? Now, the union of the local closed world assumptions will provide a lower bound on what the source definitely contains. And the advertised description has upper bound on what the source potentially contains. Okay, now if the source doesn't even potentially contain what you are looking, so suppose you are looking for movies made in Hong Kong, and this source says I'm definitely good for all the Hollywood movies, there's no point in calling this source, because even at its highest, even at its most optimistic extent, it still doesn't have the information that you're looking for. So upper bounds are used to basically figure out relevance that way. Okay? But the lower bounds can be used to stop calling other sources because you've already been called. So if in fact a query you are asking for is subsumed by this local closed world assumption, then you don't need to call any other source. Do you understand what I'm saying? If a query I'm asking for, which is if my query is Woody Allen movies, and if so, this source says, I guarantee I have all the Woody Allen movies, okay, then I don't need to call any other sources. Okay, so lower bounds are allowed, used to stop calling additional sources. Upper bounds are used to decide whether the sources should be called. And as long as we are talking about this, you notice that the way I described, lower bounds are disjunctive, because if I provide multiple, so this is the source, and then the lower bound information might say, well, no, I definitely have this, I definitely have that. So it is disjunctive. Okay. Now, upper bound information also can be disjunctive. So I just said upper bound information, you know, basically says I'm making all Hollywood, I give you all Hollywood movies. Okay. In fact, the source could have tried to say, well, instead of saying all Hollywood movies, it could have said, well, I will give you all Hollywood movies between 1950 and 1979, or all Chinese movies between 1980 and 1997. These are advertisements, so it can still be lower than that, but the advertisement itself is disjunctive. Okay, so if the advertisement is disjunctive, then it might look like this, as well as, let's say, like that. So it's basically giving two things. Okay, what's interesting is that if you are just considering source selection based on the source advertisements, and remember I was talking about local closed world as the local as view approach, it turns out that query reformulation in the local as view approach becomes intractable exactly when the source descriptions are disjunctive. Okay. Now, of course, you can say, I don't need to have it disjunctive. So this says all Hollywood movies. This says all Hong Kong movies. I will take the next bigger upper bound, which is all movies. Then again, the rewriting becomes polynomial. Okay. So the interesting trade-off here, of course, is the closer the advertisement is to reality, the harder it actually might become to decide what are the relevant sources. Okay, so this local closed world assumptions allow you to say, well, this can be a very large description, unnecessarily optimistic, but then these will tell you which parts are for sure there. So it's a different way of cutting the same thing. And having said all this, of course, LCWs may not be available unless you design the databases. Okay? Because in an adversarial web, nobody comes out and says they are anything less than complete. So either they will provide LCWs that are also made up. They'll say, yeah, sure, we have all the Woody Allen movies. Yeah, sure, we have all the Coppola movies. Okay? So they made them up. Or they would just not give anything. So if you have to learn the LCWs, that's where it becomes hard, and that's where the quantitative statistics become much more interesting. Because if you have to learn something, you're more likely to be able to learn quantitative coverage and overlap statistics. Okay? So that's the connection in terms of, but I mean, I just wanted to bring this up because local closed world assumptions are things that people still stick to, because if you design the sources yourself, you may be able to say, for sure, you know, what parts of the sources are complete. Okay. Now, one other thing I want to mention is that, so having made this query class hierarchy, the way you would wind up selecting the sources in this case would be, given a new query, you would essentially compute the statistics for the query by looking at the closest leaf level, the closest query hierarchy classes that subsume this query, and then wind up computing the query statistics as a sort of a weighted sum of those classes. Okay? To decide whether a query is close to another query class, you need to do content-based comparison. Okay, and then after that, the statistics themselves are about the distribution of how the query is distributed over sources. Okay, so that way, the whole point of this is that this way you don't have to remember the coverage and overlap statistics for individual queries. You only need to remember it for classes of queries. And when a new query comes, you identify it with some subset of classes and compute and estimate its statistics to be, a weighted sum of the statistics of the class. Okay, and then you can also learn latency statistics about sources, and as I said, and of course, for each query you can decide what is the mean time for sending tuples for this query. Again, you know, the simplest idea for any kind of a statistic would be learn it with respect to the specific queries. Okay, but then there's too many specific queries, and so unless that query comes again, you would not be able to use this information. So what you need to do is learn statistics with respect to query classes. Okay. Now the query classes for latency, normally the reasonable way to define query classes for latency would be in terms of binding patterns. It doesn't matter what you're asking about, oftentimes. What matters is which arguments are bound and which are not bound. So depending upon the source, sometimes if you just bind the author, it will take more time, whereas if you bind the title, it takes less time. Okay, so you wind up learning query pattern, the latency statistics with respect to each one of these binding patterns. And they are much fewer binding patterns than there are queries. Okay, binding pattern essentially says bound, free, bound, bound, free, free. Free, free means you did not actually bind those particular, you're not selecting those particular attributes. Now, you know, you can learn this. Now, the interesting thing, of course, so this is the kind of thing. XY1 is would be FF bound. So because X and Y are free and 1 is an actual value, so it will be bound. So you wind up learning the latency statistics for each of the binding patterns. Okay. Now, in extreme cases, certain binding patterns might have infinite latency. So for example, you know, in the Amazon book, you know, I kept making this joke about you can't ask Amazon to give you all the books which have exactly 798 pages. Now, why is that? That basically corresponds to a very specific kind of binding pattern where free, 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 bound for the pages, free, 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 free. And if you ever give that query, essentially Amazon refuses to answer it. So that basically means it has infinite latency. Okay. Now, once you start thinking about it that way, then you can say that if LCWs are the qualitative versions of the quantitative coverage and overlap statistics, then binding patterns are the qualitative versions of the quantitative latency statistics. So if all you tell me is this source will not allow certain binding patterns, that means these are infinite latency, everything else is finite. And if you want to give more information, you can say, well, this is infinite, this takes 20 seconds for the tuples, this takes 1 hour for the tuples. So you are differentiating between the finite into more, at a higher resolution. And in general, you know, if you look at the literature, you wind up seeing in the beginning people used to use qualitative ideas, you know, LCWs as well as binding patterns. And more, since those are hard to learn, you're much easier to learn the quantitative statistics. And nobody gives them anyway, because if they are autonomous sources, then they are not willing to give you what is actually easy queries, what are the hard queries. Actually, one way one can say that sources do provide you information about what binding patterns will have infinite latency. How do they do that? Well, it's not just not replying to, but if they have forms, that form would not have a field for the page number of pages. Do you understand what I'm saying? If it's a structured query, and if you have a form, then the form would not have a field for number of pages. That means you can't ask. Okay? And also sometimes they will say certain number of, certain fields must be bound. So you have to bound at least a subset of these fields. That means if you don't, then again it becomes infinite latency. Okay. Now, if you're getting all these statistics about coverages, overlaps, and if you just care about those, you can talk about how to decide which sources to call. In fact, you just did this in the homework, right? If you only have coverage and overlap statistics, you can decide what are the top k sources to call. Okay. If you only care about latency, you can also decide what are the top k sources to call. Okay. But the problem, of course, is you care about both. You care about latency as well as coverage. And the question, of course, would be how do you combine them? In general, when you are combining multiple objectives, it becomes a multi-objective optimization of source selection. Okay. And there are two ways of doing this. One, of course, is to take the multi-objective optimization problem, convert it into a single objective. So you have apples, you have oranges. You say alpha times apples plus beta times oranges is equal to fruits. And then you optimize for fruits. Okay? That's one way. Now, of course, the issue would be A, whether it's the right way to combine them, and then B, what should be the alpha and beta values. Okay. The second idea is to leave the two objectives separate, okay, all the different objectives separate, and in those cases, essentially, what multi-objective theory, optimization theory says is you consider Pareto set. So, for example, I can say 1 over latency here and coverage here, a residual coverage here, okay? And for each plan, for each set of sources, for each set of sources I'm trying to decide to pick for this query, that corresponds to a point here, corresponding to the coverage those sources will give you, and the latency, the speed at which they give their solutions. Okay, and normally one interesting thing, of course, is although apples and oranges cannot be combined, if you have 7 apples and 4 oranges, and somebody else has 6 apples and 9 oranges, they cannot be compared. You don't know which is important. Apples are important or oranges are important. Okay, but if on the other hand, your friend has 4 apples and 4 oranges, or 4 apples and 3 oranges, even. Clearly, you should be a happier guy because you have both objectives, you are better off than your friend. Do you understand what I'm saying? You may not know in the travel planning kind of a scenario, you may not know whether people care more about the cost of the travel or the time taken to travel. But you know that nobody in the world would prefer a flight which takes 10 hours and costs $100 to a flight which takes 5 hours and costs $50. Unless, of course, these are weirdo people who just like flying. Right? I mean, it's possible. But in general, for most people, for most normal people, you realize that it's dominated. Okay? So if you want to do multi-objective optimization that way, then essentially you would get what's called a Pareto set, which is the set of solutions that are non-dominated. That means every solution on this Pareto front is a solution that, for each of these solutions, there is no other solution that's better than this in both dimensions. And of course, you can then provide the entire Pareto set, and one of them is the right solution that people are looking for. Okay? So you could try to do that. In fact, a better idea in the context of query processing is that you wind up looking at a few plans on the Pareto set, you know, as the plans that are spanning the Pareto set, and then basically try to learn from the user which of these plans would satisfy their coverage and latency requirements. Do you understand what I'm saying? And then that would allow you to hopefully learn what's the right way to combine these objectives into a single objective. The reason I'm bringing this all up is that underneath the hood of computing statistics and using them, the using part can also be quite hard because you are combining apples and oranges. You know, previously, the last time we combined an apples and oranges was page rank and similarity. Now we are combining latency and coverage, etc. Okay. Having brought page rank and similarity discussion into consideration. Now, actually, let me ask a question that I was asking towards the end of last class, which is, these statistics that you compute about the sources, they in some sense are telling you which sources are likely to give most answers fastest. Okay. But if you are doing this for 5 or 6 sources that you know very well in your company, then they're all equally trustworthy. Okay? I mentioned when we started talking about deep web that supposedly there are 25 million sources or more on the web. Now, are all these sources going to be equally trustworthy? Of course not, because you make up sources where you make up movies and director names, whatever comes to your mind, and you know, either because you have no clue or because you want to catch people and you know, by you know, giving them wrong information. Okay, so the question then is, in fact, all of this combination, you know, combining residual coverage with latency, by the way, this particular combination here, I combined residual coverage with latency in a discounted fashion. This is an interesting way of combining, that it's not alpha times x plus beta times y, it's a discounted combination, and I should mention that that's a good way of combining things in several scenarios. The basic idea is the discounted models essentially say, if I'm going to give you $10 today versus $100 20 days from now, which is better for you? How do you compare $10 today to $100 20 days from now? Or $1 billion 200 years from now? Right? How do you compare? And in general, this becomes an important issue, how to compare rewards across wide time scales. And one reasonable way of doing that is to discount the reward exponentially with respect to the time. Okay? Where the gamma factor is the discount factor. If gamma equal to 1, that means $20 today is equal to you as $20 20 days from now is equal to $20 20 billion years from now. Okay? Whereas if gamma is close to 0, that means give me now. You know, I'll give you $2 now, or don't say R, I just want now. You know, I don't even need to know what else you're going to say. Do you understand what I'm saying? I don't care about R. This is how my son works, for example. You know, it doesn't matter what you're going to give me later. Give me now, whatever you're going to give. Okay? That basically assumes that who knows how long we'll live. Right? And so we just want to get the reward right now. So gamma equal to 0, you live for today. Gamma equal to 1, you are essentially crazy person who thinks that, you know, happiness 20 billion years from now, you know, 2 units of happiness 20 billion years from now is equal to 2 units of happiness today. And in between, we'll tell you, changing gamma between 0 and 1 will tell you, you know, and I'm not even saying gamma greater than 1, because that means you're crazier than the crazy person, where you don't want to be happy today at all, you only want to be happy later. You know, that's much worrisome to me. But so gamma maximum is equal to 1, and the discount factor is a good way of combining, and in fact you learn the person's discount factor. This way of combining, is this a Pareto set based approach for multi-objective combination, or a single, is it making it a single objective? I'm asking you like a dumb question just to see how many people are awake. What? It's single. When you're combining an apples and oranges, it doesn't have to be a linear combination. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, when we combined page rank and similarity, we did it in the dumbest way possible, and which is alpha times similarity plus beta times page rank. You could at least have, to impress the reviewers, you could have taken double log of similarity times alpha plus sine of page rank, and that would have been much more interesting. That would still be a single objective optimization. Okay. The point, of course, is whenever you combine them, you better have a nice story as to why this way of combining makes sense. And I gave you the story for this, which is discounted reward model. Okay. But all of this really is assuming that you believe the source. Assuming that you believe the source. Okay. So I would say this is for source selection what similarity is for page selection. And you need one more piece of information, which is, should I trust you? If all of them are equally trustworthy, then whoever wins on this wins. If not, you need to have a separate way of figuring out. Now, of course, I told you the last time that I was going to run to figure out some idea that my student was working on. And here is a kind of a harebrained idea right now, in the sense, it's not harebrained, I think. I mean, you all should pray that this paper will get accepted so that, you know, at least you would have thought you'd learned something that's actually vetted by somebody else. But here's an interesting idea where you could do page rank style computation on the sources. Okay, so if you can have links between sources, then you can do page rank style computation. The problem, of course, is sources don't put links to each other. Okay, now what you could do is you could essentially compute the links between sources in some sort of an indirect way. And the idea that Raju came up with essentially is to say that the degree of agreement between two sources on a sampled set of queries corresponds to their endorsement of each other. And the basic idea is that if you made up a source which involves all sorts of made up movie information, such as, you know, Godfather was made by Woody Allen and Annie Hall was made by, you know, somebody else, you know, so you made up all this information, the likelihood that the way you made up the information is the same way somebody else will make up the information is very low. Whereas the likelihood that two of you would agree is higher if both of you are actually talking about the real entities that exist in the world. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? So if you wind up considering, so this is the true set of relevant results, and sources will wind up having overlaps, you know, the overlaps in terms of the true set of relevant results will give you some notion of the endorsement between them. And then you can make up what's called an agreement graph and then do essentially the same notion of Markov random walk, the random walk on this Markov chain. And then that will give you the same sort of the importance measure for sources the way you used to get it for pages. Okay? And he made some pictures there trying to show that that kind of a thing will work. And more importantly, you can see why it would work, because to the extent there are adversarial sources, the way you make up information would be the same as somebody else will make up the information is very low, unless you there is a huge collusion. But when there is a huge collusion, page rank dies too. If a huge number of pages decide to put links to each other, page rank dies. That's when Brin and Page come in and remove their, make their page rank to be zero. You understand what I'm saying? So this is the kind of thing where, in this particular case, the trustworthiness of source is being computed in a global sense with respect to all other sources. And then that can be combined with this using alpha times this plus beta times that. Okay? And that's how you would now wind up selecting sources. So you are selecting sources almost the same way you are selecting pages to display. This is source ranking. Previously we talked about page ranking, but you could do some of the same sorts of ideas. Okay? And the important thing, of course, is that trust is sort of a more global, globally computed entity, whereas all these other things, coverage, etc., are only based on that particular source. The latency of a source depends only on it, not on other sources. Trustworthiness of a source depends on whether or not it agrees with anybody else. Okay? So that's the other point I wanted to make. And then that gets me to the last little point I want to make before ending this discussion, which is basically I mentioned in this picture, which you may have seen two classes back, that we were talking about query reformulation and optimizing access to sources until now. But then I also said another thing that you want to support in terms of information, you know, query processing in information integration is supporting imprecision and incompleteness. Okay, and the point I want to make is, why should you actually care about imprecision and incompleteness in databases? Okay, the reason, of course, is maybe this is not too surprising to you by now, because I may have said these kinds of things before, but many of the sources that are on the web are either populated by humans or automatically extracted. Okay, in either case, they're likely to be erroneous, they're likely to have all sorts of missing values. That means there may be attributes for which you don't know the values. Okay, and so the interesting question, of course, is that really in a larger scheme of things, if you have IR in one end and pure databases in other end, information integration is sort of in the middle, because the tuples really are probabilistic tuples. When you have a tuple that you extracted from somewhere, or some user actually included it, it really corresponds potentially to a distribution over real objects that exist in the world. Okay, for example, to make that point, suppose I said in a used car database, somebody, let's say, did not put the manufacturer of the car, but said Accord is the model, the price is $2,000 and all that fun stuff. Okay, so they did not put manufacturer, that's a null value. One can actually say that this actually corresponds to a union of tuples. One of those is the real tuple that exists. My assumption is that if somebody took the time to enter this, hopefully an actual car existed that they wanted to sell. But presumably they just, you know, didn't put the, you know, in this particular case you can see why they didn't put, because everybody knows who makes Accords. Okay, so they assume that other people will be looking at it and they'll know who made Accords. But if you have a little integration system in the middle, it may not know who makes Accords. And if it's being asked a query, get me all the Honda cars, it'll miss this tuple, because it doesn't know what its value is, what its manufacturer is. So in fact, if you look at this tuple, this corresponds to a union of everything Toyota Accord 2000, everything Honda Accord 2000, everything Ford Accord 2000, etc. Okay, because this particular missing value can be one of Toyota, Honda, GM, Chrysler, Ford, Renault, and all these various manufacturers. So it corresponds, if you do that, that would be the non-deterministic semantics. That would correspond to the non-deterministic semantics. So one null value tuple corresponds to, essentially, non-deterministically, to one of this set of tuples. You can go a little farther, and you can say I can provide probabilistic semantics, where you will be able to say that really the probability that it's going to be Honda is 0.8, and you know probability that it's going to be GM is 0.3, or not 0.2, or 0.01, or something. Okay. So if you do that, then you provided a distribution over the non-deterministic set of tuples, and then that will be a stochastic tuple. Okay. And then, in fact, one huge area right now is how to do query processing on stochastic databases. And there are two challenges there. One is who gives you the numbers. Whenever you want numbers, somebody has to give you the numbers. How do you assess the numbers, and how do you use them in the query processing? Okay, and that winds up being very important. So in fact, this one is just showing you that in many actual online humanly generated, humanly populated databases, a large number of incomplete tuples, tuples with lots of null values. And similarly, if there are databases which extract information to the extent extraction techniques are wrong, they will also wind up having incomplete or basically incorrect tuples. And each tuple now will have a number associated with it as to, basically each tuple corresponds to a probability distribution over real objects in the world. Then you need to use that, okay? Now, how about imprecise queries? That's about the tuples themselves are uncertain. Okay, the tuples themselves are uncertain. Now, if the user asks a precise query, if they knew exactly what they're looking for and they ask, give me Toyota car, you know, that's precise query. But what if users actually ask imprecise queries? And there's very good reason to believe that users ask imprecise queries, because the users who are asking queries to a database are the same users who are asking queries to Google. And why did they become nicely smarter one day? You know, just because they're talking to databases. Okay, if they were asking imprecise queries before, they're still asking imprecise queries. The question then would be, given a query, want a sedan priced around 7,000, and then the user probably will make a query up saying, oh, give me Toyota Camry less than 7,000. And then, so now what if, in fact, you know, the normal database would give only Toyota Camrys, but definitely less than 7,000. But what if, for example, there is a Camry for about 7,100? What if, even more interestingly, there's an Accord or a Passat which is less than $7,000? My assumption is that people who are likely to be interested in Camrys may also be interested in Accords. Okay, how do I know this? How does the system know that when you're asking a query, it's really a union of potential queries? Okay, And to do this, we come full circle and really say that database style query processing and IR style query processing used to be two different ends of the spectrum that we looked at, but really you need a bridge. You know, if people are asking imprecise queries over uncertain databases, then there is huge temptation to say, to heck with it. Let's write all the tuples as text files and do keyword queries. Do you understand what I'm saying? But if you want to do better than that, then in essence, you want to essentially do IR, which is structure aware. And our database styles, basically database and IR, information retrieval systems, are much more closely connected than you might have thought. Okay? And, okay, so I'll just flash this and say this is more of my work, you know, some work that's going on in my group. And basically, you can think of handling imprecise queries. Whenever there are imprecise queries, you can handle it by computing the user relevance function. This is what we did for information retrieval long, long back. And if you didn't know how to compute the, you know, how to estimate the retrieval function, you said, well, it's connected to the similarity. Okay? And similarly, whenever there is incomplete data, you need a density model, basically, which says this corresponds to a particular distribution of real tuples over this this null value. Okay? You can learn both density and relevance functions from the data and from the user interaction. I won't tell you how to, but you know, you can read some of the work that's going on. And then you can combine them. You can get expected relevance ranking at that point. Okay, if you have relevance itself, you can do relevance ranking. And if you have density information, then it basically is giving you expected relevance, which is probability times the relevance. Okay, and then you can decide to rank the tuples in that order. Okay, now of course, in doing so, you still are in database world. And the problem is, if you, one of the ways, the requirements for learning this would be needing, would require you to get samples of the databases. Now the databases won't, for example, one of the things that you cannot do to a database is give me all the tuples which happen to have null on the manufacturer column. You know, some allow, most don't allow, because you know, null is not a selection attribute. I mean, null is not a selection value. So if you want to bring this out even, you need to find indirect ways of bringing this tuple out. Just as when I needed to find out which books actually had 711 pages, and Amazon wouldn't give me that information, I found a way of query rewriting, which basically kept sending titles and look at the results and see if that happens to have, you know, 711 pages. And if not, look at more books that are being shown on that particular page and send them back again. That idea is query rewriting, and you wind up needing query rewriting in this context too. Okay? And then finally, if you provide, if you're a database person, if you give an answer, it's an answer. People don't ask, why is this an answer? Okay, so for example, you ask the next semester's course database, okay, tell me what CSE courses are still having open seats, and it'll show you some results. Okay, and it doesn't have to explain why it is saying that. But if somebody was looking for cars made by Honda, and I want to give them this as a tuple, okay, because I believe that this null value is really a card. Okay, how do I convince the user that they should take me seriously? You need explanation. Okay, so essentially, what happens in this kind of a context is that a database manager is a sort of a recommender system. It takes your query as the beginning, and it recommends tuples, and it gives explanations. So that sort of combines everything that's going on in the course. You know, so you combine information retrieval, you combine relevance measures, you combine uncertainty, and you also combine explanations, which are basically the way recommender systems work. So, you know, there is a system that we have which, for example, will give you, ask the query like, give me all the cars which are Civics. It will give you these, of course, because they are certainly Civics. And then it will give you incomplete answers like these because it believes they are Civics. And how did it believe that? Because it learned patterns in the data based on the rest of the tuples and they say, and then figured out that this null value is more likely to be civic than not. Okay? And then it also figures out that if you are into civic, maybe you are interested in Accord and Prelude too, and shows them to you too. And that, of course, is about similarity. So that means you ask for one thing, I show you. Remember in IR, we used to say, if this is your keyword, I will expand the keywords and say, would you be interested in these other things too? That's what is happening now in databases. And of course, it's happening in databases means it happens in the information integration. Okay? And then one other slide I want to show you. I'll skip over this. Is that too much for you right now? And then, you know, you can provide, you have to provide, whenever you have null values, you have to provide explanations. This is from some system that we have actually developed. You can read up on that from my webpage paper. This is Quick or QPR, one of them. This one is Quick. But the other thing I want to point out is, how do you, for example, figure out that certain values are connected to certain other values? How do you figure out that Accords are more similar to Camrys than they are to some car that Yugo makes without being told that? Right? I said this and you agreed because it sort of agreed with your common sense. But I can't ask you, you know, what else are the cars? I mean, I can, one thing I could do in doing similar queries is to say, yeah, I know you want Camrys, but what else do you want? If I can't get you Camrys, what else do you want? Or you can try to automatically figure out what else I might be interested in because I'm interested in this. To do that, I need to get what other values are close to Camrys. Okay, I'll end with this really simplistic way of figuring this out, mostly because you sort of, you know, it's the same old bag of similarity idea. Okay, and then you can try these kinds of ideas first before you improve them. Okay, so one idea here is to figure out whether Toyota, whether Camry and Accord are close or not. What I could do is consider all the rows whose model happens to be Camry, and all the rows whose model happens to be Accord. These union of rows need to be compared. If they are similar, then you are in good shape. Okay. Now, instead of comparing these rows, I can basically say I will union the rows. So each row with respect to, so my model is Camry, so then I will consider all the manufacturers for the Camry, all the prices for the Camry, all the, you know, mileages for the Camry. So I get one single vector now for Camry, which corresponds to the union of values for its manufacturers, union of values for its, basically the other tuples, the other attributes. And you compare this vector to the other vector made for Accord. It looks like a dumb idea, should be easy to defeat. Because in fact, in particular, if I make a large number of irrelevant tuples which just happen to have agreement, then you would wind up, you know, seeing spurious connections. Okay, but again, that can be said for pretty much every kind of similarity metric that we learned in the class. Okay, so all I'm saying is you should try these kinds of things first and then see how far you can go from there. And in this particular case, if you do this simple idea, it turns out that the similarities that you get for car models is pretty darn interesting. It more or less agrees with your intuition. Why? Because the data is made, it's not randomly generated. It actually corresponds to existing cars. Okay? And the agreement between the tuples would actually mean something in terms of similarity. Okay? So, the review of topic 3 is more or less my main review, and then the last one would be just say that the course is over. Okay? But because you did not review this as much yourself, for the topic 3, we spent time on finding, representing, and exploiting structure. Okay? And getting structure, using structure, you know, are the two major parts. Getting the structure, we talked about XML, and also, you know, where basically people get to decide the tags and put it together. Or you can talk about wrapper generation, or information extraction, which takes the text-oriented data sources, brings the structure out. Those are the ways you can bring structure out. Using the structure, you can use the structure for database style query processing. You can also do it to improve IR style query processing by increasing the indexes. We talked about it. Okay? And then finally, when you have multiple sources, then there are interesting alignment problems that come up. You need to align the structures, you need to align the data. And we talked about that too. And for those, we talked about both the semantic web style ideas, and we also talked about machine learning style ideas for schema mapping as well as value similarities. In fact, I would say the last slide I looked at, this is sort of value similarities. If this kind of a technique, if in fact there are certain names that are misspelled, you know, consistently in some databases, then if to the extent they seem to have the same kind of other column values, then they must be the same. So if you can do similarity between values like this, then you will wind up being able to find the similarity between what should have been identical but were misspelled. Okay, so this is the value mapping, you know, and previously we talked about schema mapping, which is a simple idea. Okay, so 5 minutes of bigger review. Basically, let's see, this moves. Basically showing you all the slides I showed you in the first day. Okay, so we said that we'll talk about how search engines work and whether web can be seen as a collection of semi-structured databases and whether useful patterns can be mined from pages and data on the web. I believe we did some of that. The main topics were these, more or less we did that. And I said most of the course would be adapting existing disciplines to what we want to do. And we talked about four disciplines: information retrieval, databases, data mining, social networks. And for all of which, we first talked about the traditional views and how they have to change in the context of web. Okay, and then these are the topics covered. And basically, I don't need to go into that, but you know, you can look at them. And then I showed you these sweet spots on the web, you know, and some general ideas, and I probably added one more slide, but you should consider, I mean, I think some of your discussions today came to look at some of the, you know, cross-cutting themes, but here are a couple of slides. One of which is finding sweet spots in computer-mediated cooperative work, and to me, bag of words versus bag of letters is a great way to remember it. You know, bag of words, bag of letters, bag of shingles. Okay, if you do bag of shingles, you can improve precision, right? But it's also costlier. Bag of letters is going to give you a lot more recall, but if precision is going to be really bad. If the humans are in the loop, bag of words seems to be a reasonable way, because humans it's really, when the humans are in the loop, all you need to do is to stop the human from stalking away from the computer, saying, how stupid are you? I don't want to deal with you anymore. Okay, and basically are stalking away from the computer because you're taking so long that, you know, the useful answer you give would be 2 days too late. And the shingles is one end, bag of letters is the other end, bag of words is in the middle. So the question is, what other sweet spots can you find? You know, is something that you want to think about. Okay. The other thing, of course, we did not do as much of it, but it's a big theme in the web in general, is essentially collaborative. In fact, let me come back to this big idea. Let's do the big idea three first, which is to realize that the web data is not randomly generated. The most telling example that we saw just 4 slides back is we looked at essentially a super tuple similarity between the model Camry and the model Accord and found they are similar. This wouldn't have happened if you just generated random tuples. It happened because they correspond to existing cars. Okay, and in fact many ideas work because, such as word co-occurrences would mean, you know, synonyms, because these are English documents that mean something to somebody. Okay, and understanding that in fact web is really a collective unconscious. By the way, this picture, I think I mentioned it to you guys before, right? Who is this? Carl Jung, who is a great psychologist, who essentially talked about the collective unconscious. Okay, and web is in some sense the collective unconscious, and so it's not random. And so if you find co-occurrences there, then they are actually likely to have something to do with meaning. Whereas finding co-occurrences on random data may not have anything to do with meaning. Okay? So analyzing term co-occurrences, analyzing the link structure, analyzing, most recently I talked about agreement structure between the sources, analyzing the supertuple similarity between values, all of these work because web is not random. Okay? And then finally, the other big thing is to say that the collaborative computing is a big useful thing because as we pointed out a couple of times, you know, the biggest drain of CPU in the world is our own brain, and they're not doing anything much. And now they are, you know, looking at the web, so can you steal their brain cycle to do something useful? Okay, I didn't talk too much about this. Collaborative tagging, collaborative curation are examples, but really to get people to do something, you need to be Tom Sawyer, right? Tom Sawyer basically had to, remember, he had to paint his fence, but he started showing orgiastic pleasure in doing it that all the friends wanted to do it for him. Okay, you need to make it look as if they will have a lot of fun doing free work for you. And unfortunately, we don't teach this to you in computer science, you know, but it's a useful thing to learn how to get, you know, it interesting to people. And in fact, I think we talked about ESP games, etc., which are some ideas in that direction. But it does matter. In fact, in the Wikipedia case, I pointed out that you can, for example, after you come up with a info box that doesn't exist, you extracted it by looking at the text, you want to validate it. And if the validation can be done by user free, that would be good. Okay, another Amazon example that comes to my mind. In fact, Amazon has most recently come up with an app, a free app in the App Store for iPhones, and this guy spent the entire life looking at the iPhone. So you tell me, what is that iPhone app? This is the end of the semester, so I don't have to be nice to anybody. Yes, go ahead. Exactly. So you have this iPhone, so you keep taking pictures of all the entities and upload them. There's an easy way of uploading them, and then they will connect up, you know, their basic entities on the Amazon Web Database to these things. Collaborative computation. They're getting it easy for, you know, basically they're getting work done for you. They also have a dumb idea, which is this MSARC idea, where they pay you money to actually do stuff. Never pay money to people, you know. I mean, that's not a good idea, okay? And then the last one, big idea four, this is something that I didn't mention last time, is if you do not take autonomous adversarial nature of the web into account, then it's going to bite you. Okay, web isn't a stabilized environment that your parents made when you were a little kid so that you know, all the plugs are, you know, plugged so that you won't put your hands in. All the hot stuffs are put far away so you won't put your hands in. That's not the way it is. So people actually make sources which have made up data. People actually put White House page, which is not a White House page. And you need to understand that. You need to figure that out, and you need to look at ways of handling the adversarial nature of the web. And any global analysis of the kind of authorities have, PageRank, and most recently the one I told you, which is this agreement between sources, those are all ideas directly meant to take into account the adversarial nature of the web. You can ignore it for a day, but after that you have to start worrying about adversarial nature of the web. Okay? So this is my last but one slide. So there's basically this guy, John Barclay, who was an English anatomist. At the turn of the century, he wound up having to give a lecture to an invited audience of anatomists. Okay? And then he said the following things about people and about the state of anatomy at that point of time. He said, first come, anatomy may be likened to a harvest field. First come the reapers who, entering upon untrodden ground, cut down great store of corn from all sides of them. These are the early anatomists. These are the ones who did the greatest amounts of work. Okay? Then come the gleaners, and then finally come the geese, who still contrive to pick up a few grains of scattered here and there among the stubble and actually make the maximum joyous cries. And then he said, gentlemen, we are the geese. Okay? At the turn of the century, this great anatomist basically said, there's nothing left to do in anatomy. and we will pick little pieces here and there, and we celebrate thinking, wow, we are smart. Okay, that would be a reasonably depressing way to live life. I think anatomy is depressing enough, but I think if I know that I'm similar to geese, then I'll be depressed. All I want to tell you is information integration on the web is still rife with uncertain. Now, all you did, in fact, the very first thing I started by saying to you is, don't get impressed with anything. You know, basically what you have seen is really, really small beginnings. Okay? There's a lot and lot of uncut corn out there, and I hope, so unlike the anatomy of Barclay's day, web is still young, and we're still just figuring out how to tap its potential. Okay? It's not a physics undergraduate class where at the end of which you just get depressed saying all the important stuff is done. It's a different kind of an undergraduate-graduate class where you actually realize what's been done, but also realize how much more is there left to do. And I hope you have a large amount of uncut corn in front of you, and I just hope that you'll get to cut some of your own. Thank you for all your attention. I'll see you on next Tuesday, right, for the final exam. Thank you.